Once more unto the breach, dear friends, else close the wall up with our English dead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and...
Jeff.
McClure. This is The Personal Wealth Coach. As I just said, I'm Jake McClure. That's Jeff McClure. We're both bald. We're related to each other, thus the last name. He is Elder Baldy and is also my father. It's crazy how he can be both at the same time. The Personal Wealth Coach, let me start with our disclosures. Do you want to start a disclosure?
I think I can do starting a disclosure.
Hey, you sound great again. Whatever you did worked.
Yeah, I just started going through things and unplugging things and replugging things and rebooting things.
It worked.
The Personal Wealth Coach is also, is not only the name of a SEC registered investment advisor. It's not only the name of this radio program. It's also the name of a registered investment advisor based in Salado, Texas, that is registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, which does not imply in any way that they approve of what we're doing. Just says we have over $100 million under management, so we have to register with them, and they have to regulate us.
Yep.
And so we're involved in the, what was the war with Billy the Kid?
The moderators versus the regulators, the Lincoln County
Yes,
Wars?
Yes, it's the Lincoln County War, the moderators versus regulators. We think we're moderators, and they think they're regulators, so we're trying to kill each other.
No, we're not. Definitely not. We have not been deputized by anyone, legal or otherwise.
But the SEC does not approve or disapprove anything that we do, but we're registered with them anyway.
Yes.
And let's see, what is this? So we're registered, we did that. We don't pay for the radio program. I'm supposed to disclose that too. But we also pay for advertising on KTEM for the radio program. But they advertise for the radio program too, so it's kind of hard to figure out which is what on that. You want to go through another one?
Yeah. You hit all of the ones that I usually hit, so I'm going to do the deem.
See if you can do it right.
I'm going to make it my own. All of the information that we talk to you about on this radio program comes from sources that we deem to be reliable. However, we make no warranty, nor do we make a guarantee about any of the accuracy or completeness of that information, said, written, or otherwise. Implication, inferred, or uninferred. What else? Said information or written? If you read this stuff...
We make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information.
Yeah, but
you got to say it really quickly.
What if it's written? And I have to do it in a monotone. I got to get more practice on that one. I don't need to talk like this and speak like I'm in a car commercial. Please avoid paper cuts at all costs. There you go. Did we hit all of them?
No.
Educational content. There we go.
Something. Yes, educational, not advice.
Just because we just said in that other disclosure before this one that the information that we give as fiduciaries under the SEC side of investment advice is given a, you know, great deal of personal information is known and so on. We don't do that on the radio because we don't know everybody that's listening to us. Well, maybe we do. Maybe actually no one is listening to us. And then we could give fiduciary investment advice very easily just by being absolutely silent. And it would be appropriate to one.
Would that be advice? Because that's advice to do nothing.
Yeah, that's advice. I mean, but seeing as we don't know everybody out there, we can't give blanket fiduciary advice. So we give blanket educational content, which is very different. It is something to help you make a decision rather than advising you on all the ins and outs and how it would affect you directly on any advice.
And even when we give advice, we don't give tax or legal advice.
That's true. Ever.
We could add that as another disclosure.
Yes, we are not attorneys. We are not tax advisors. Not only are we not attorneys and not tax advisors, attorneys and tax advisors have advised us not to be attorneys and tax advisors. There. That's not quite appropriately legalese yet. We got to work on that one. We got to bore everyone.
And say it faster.
Yes.
Bigger words.
Bigger words, say it faster in a monotone, and then it sounds really important. But that we're actually not only going to give you disclosures all day long. We're also going to talk about what happened in the market this week.
Go ahead. We're going to tell you that if you want to join in on the radio program, you can, but it has to be done by email. And you can email us either at Jake at tpwc.com or Jeff at tpwc.com.
And we already
see how succinctly.
Yeah, we already got a question in even before we sent that out. What happened in the market this week?
Did something happen in the market this week?
I think that people did some trading back and forth, but pretty much same thing that happened the week before and the week before and the week before, which is people showed up and did trading and then went home. I think that covers it all, actually. You may not actually have to say any more. In the market, things were traded. At the end of the trading, the prices were different than at the beginning of the trading. And then everybody went home and had a weekend.
In the stock market, a lot of stock was traded, but no stock. No actual stock, like cattle.
No stock, like no livestock or soup stock. Well, maybe some in the commodities market.
It could be some soup stock going around. Campbell's is public.
Yeah, it's true.
Anyway.
We are on a roll this
morning. Exciting on Monday. The stock market was exciting on Monday and boring the rest of the week.
Yep.
Pretty much says it. On Monday, the S&P 500 plunged by the close 1.6%. At one point, it was down 2.3% and headed towards a correction. I mean, there was a stampede out the door. And after the fact, there was some analysis done about who started buying at that point and headed off the stampede. And it turned out it was mostly young individual investors, which proves that Jamie Dimon, the head of J.P. Morgan, knows what he's talking about, because last week he said that there's a lot of young investors with a lot of money who are going to invest in the market's going to go up as a result. Now, whether he's right about the market's going to go up, I don't know, but he said there's a lot of buying left to be done. So we started off with this big drop at the beginning of the week, and that was because the Delta variant of COVID caused a apparent fourth wave to start in COVID infections in the United States. And it's whether it's third wave or fourth wave or whatever it is slamming the rest of the world. Nike, for example, is having to reduce production because they're shutting down factories in India because of massive Delta variant COVID infections. And they were concerned it was going to choke off the recovery. Now, remember, the last time the market dipped is because of inflation, because there was too much demand and the economy is running too hot, and they were afraid the Federal Reserve was going to raise interest rates. So this time, the market took a dip because they were afraid the recovery was going to collapse. The market, meaning the people who do the trading on a daily basis, is looking for something to be afraid of, which is a good sign, by the way. That indicates we're in a bull market. Anyway, we started off with this dip, and then the market recovered, not completely, but did a very nice recovery on Tuesday morning. Why did it recover on Tuesday morning? Well, because a lot of people, the officials and the CDC and so on, said they didn't think it was all that serious. And the governors came out and said, we're not going to lock down again. And people started buying and the market came back. It also helped that during the week we had earnings reports coming in from the second quarter. And then we're having an unusually high number of corporations that report from the S&P 500, for example, that are reporting above estimate earnings. In other words, the earnings are estimated by the analysts, and we say this is about how much money per share this company is likely to have profited in the second quarter. And so far, 85% of the companies reporting for the second quarter have come in substantially above estimate, which is an unusually high number. Usually about 60 to 70% do, and we're up to 85%. In other words, the second quarter was apparently better than the analysts thought it was going to be. In the market, it's largely based on where the analysts think earnings are going. At least in the growth side of the market. So all this started going on. And what was really funny, at least to me, not funny, strange, interesting.
I'll laugh at it. I've got a weird sense of humor, though.
Was the volatility virtually disappeared from the market from Tuesday forward. The rise in the S&P 500 was smooth and looked like somebody had put a ruler across it and drawn a line. It just moved up very smoothly for the rest of the week. And it ended up at 1.96%, closing at 4411.79. That's a new record. Another week, another record. The S&P 500 is up 17.46% this year. Now, we got to say something about the Dow Jones Industrial Average here, because we don't normally talk about it. It's only 30 stocks, and it is figured differently than the S&P 500. It's less representative of the market than the S&P 500. But the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed above 35,000 for the first time on Friday. You can mark that down in your memory. I like those round numbers because I remember when they happened. I remember when the S&P 500 closed above 4,000. I thought that was pretty impressive.
We've kind of covered this in the past about how round numbers for some reason bear significance. I mean, nobody reports about the Dow breaking through 9,642. Or, I mean, that's not a big deal. People say, well, why'd you tell me that? But as soon as it's a round number, it's 10,000 or it's 35,000. That's important and worthy of a headline. There's no significance other than in our heads about that. But the significance in our head influences prices. Just a weird thing. Just keep that in mind. This is why people still charge you $19.99 for something instead of $20. $20 is a round number and has significance. And when it's a benefit round number, you get this great result. And when it's a cost round number, people say, oh, that's too high. So just be aware. There's no real difference except the way we experience reality. Basically, it's a big difference. No difference now, except for the big one.
Something interesting again is still continuing to occur. The yield on the U.S. 10-year U.S. Treasury note, which is the benchmark yield for the economy, for a lot of interest rates that are charged on mortgages and so on, it fell to 1.279%. Now, it was up around 1.75 back in May. It's down to 1.279. 4 weeks ago, it was up around 1.5. So the interest rates on the 10-year Treasury note are continuing to fall. Now, under normal circumstances, whatever that is, falling interest rates on the 10-year Treasury would indicate that somebody thinks that the economy is going to slow down and there's no danger of inflation. At the same time, there's apparently great fear of inflation, but the 10-year Treasury note is yielding 1.279%. That's weird. Until you realize that the world is out of whack right now. This is not normal.
There's not anything really normal that we could say since maybe February of 2020. There's just not been a normalcy in here. But we can look back at other unnormal times, and this is what we're seeing a repeat of. A normal repeat of an unnormal time.
There's a couple of things going on here. Number one, the Treasury is not issuing a lot of new Treasury notes. We're issuing very few because they're pulling them out of the Federal Reserve. So they've got a big reserve at the Federal Reserve, which is kind of weird.
That's kind of why they call it the Federal Reserve.
But the Treasury has a bunch of money stored there that they've built up over time. And under the law, by the end of July, they have to have that down to $450 billion. And it's like $780 billion. So they're drawing out of there rather than issuing new Treasury securities. And I don't frankly see at the rate they're withdrawing how they're going to get it all out of there in time, which is going to be weird. Why is July 31st a big deal? Because July 31st is when the debt ceiling law goes back into effect. And if Congress doesn't pass a rise to the debt ceiling, eventually the Treasury runs out of money and the government shuts down again.
This is, again, a repeat of an unnormal time, but it's normal enough that we should all have memories of potential government shutdowns and budgets not being approved yet. So this is part of the thing that's going on with the infrastructure plan and several of the other things, is that there's budgetary issues in those plans that need to be passed so that the government continues. And we've passed the borrowing ceiling or very close to it there.
Yeah. And some senators on the Republican side in the Senate have said they're not going to raise the debt ceiling. So you want something to worry about, that's something else you can worry about for a while.
Just for the fun of it. If you're lacking in things to worry about when people are talking about the Delta variant or, you know, any of these strange things that sound terrifying, and you don't have enough to be terrified about, well, we've got more for you there.
At any rate, the yield has been dropping. For that reason, it's also been dropping because the Federal Reserve is buying Treasury securities on the open market to hold interest rates down. And it's also been dropping for another reason, a very big reason, and that is there's a lot of money buying Treasury securities. And as the bond price goes up and people buy more and more of something that's in short supply, the price goes up. And as the price goes up, the effective interest rate goes down. That's just the way bonds work. I won't explain that. We could try to explain it, but it's rough.
It takes a little bit of time, but we could do it in a way that people understand. Let me just real quick. If you're at a bank and another bank offers you a higher interest rate to move your money over there, you're more likely to do it, which causes the asset at the first bank to be worth less because you moved it over. And that's a very, very basic and impartial description of what's going on. It's supply and demand. higher interest rate bonds look better to everybody that wants to buy a bond. Lower interest rates don't look as good, so the money tends to move from one to the other. When you're selling one thing, it tends to go down in price. When you're buying another thing, it tends to go up in price. That's just the way it works. There's complexity in there as long as you look at it in a complex way. It's really just, would you rather have a high interest rate bond or a low interest rate bond if they're the same risk? And people go, well, I'd rather have the high interest rate. What causes the low interest rate to be worth less?
And all over the world, where the Delta variant is raging and economies are in danger and a lot of people are scared, they want to, people who have a lot of money and governments who have a lot of money want to put their money someplace where they have some degree of reliability in getting it back when the bond matures. And they're buying 10-year treasury notes, even though the 10-year treasury note is probably below inflation. In other words, inflation is estimated to run by the kind of a consensus of economists and the Congressional Budget Office and the Fed and everybody else at about 2.25% to 2.5% over the next 10 years or so. So the yield is 1.279, which means you're losing 1% a year if you own a treasury note.
Based on just inflation, yeah.
But it's kind of like democracy. It may be a lousy place to put your money, but it's better than all the rest. Because if you look at all the other places that will guarantee a return on your money, guarantee that they guarantee a return of your money.
They're going to return the money. We guarantee.
There's only one developed large economic entity in the world that pays this high an interest rate, and that's the United States. And there's another factor here that the pundits that I've been reading have not taken into account when they're feverishly debating as to why the interest rates keep falling. And that is that the dollar is up 3% so far this year.
That's a big deal.
So if you bought a treasury at the beginning of the year that's yielding 1.2%, you have gained an extra 3% on it if you live outside the United States. And, well, that's an average.
Right.
So the dollar is rising. Well, it's one of those weird things. It's like the market. The dollar is rising because a lot of people are buying treasuries. And why are they buying treasuries? They're buying treasuries because the dollar is rising. And when you don't, in order to buy treasuries, you have to buy dollars to buy the treasuries with. It's all a pretty complex issue. But the bottom line to it is that the United States dollar is still the reserve currency of the world. It's still considered the most secure place in the world to put money. It has risen when gold has fallen. The rest of the world is convinced that the United States Treasury and the United States dollar is solid, and they're buying it.
So far, so good.
The other index that we follow is oil. West Texas Intermediate Oil is the one we follow. It fell less than 1% to 72.08. Interestingly enough, it falls when the dollar rises, so that has an effect on it. But it fell on Tuesday. Price of oil fell on Tuesday for the same reason the market went down, fear that the recovery was stalling, and then it recovered very quickly and round up less than 1% down. It's trading between $70 and $75 a barrel, and it seems to be pretty stable there. And then it's a little surprising because OPEC came out with an announcement that they had reached an agreement with the United Arab Emirates, and they were going to pump more oil. Normally that causes the price of West Texas Intermediate Oil to fall because there's going to be more oil on the market in the future. Instead, it stabilized, which tells you that's an indicator that our economy is doing well. And if you don't know why that would happen, all you have to do is try to drive on I-35.
Yeah. There's a limit at which we cannot drive anymore. Yesterday, we had it back, and we do a newsletter every week, and we had it back and forth. I'm out of pocket right now. I'm not that I'm ever actually in someone's pocket. I'm in Colorado and doing the radio from Colorado. And I went from Denver to Fort Collins yesterday, and then back from Fort Collins to Denver. And the traffic was obscene by any definition. It was, and just to let you know that I am open-minded in this approach, I recognize that I was part of the same traffic that I'm calling obscene. But it's a statement of, at some point, there's only so much gasoline you can use. If enough people are trying hard to use the gasoline to move from one place to another, it slows everyone down. So there's like a maximum consumption rate, if you will. That's kind of tongue-in-cheek because you can't really measure that easily. But it puts a limit on that upward pressure on gasoline as well, on oil in general. there's other stuff happening that's putting a limit on the upward movement of oil in general, and that is that there's a massive move across a lot of industries over into other types of energy, mostly renewable, but natural gas being part of that. Now, natural gas, you would think, well, that's part of the petroleum, right? So the thing is that natural gas prices now are no longer moving quite as in lockstep with the price of West Texas Intermediate or any other crude oil prices. Because with fracking, depending on how fast we're fracking, the percentage of natural gas that comes out of that can be quite large or quite small. So what does that have to do with all of this? It means that we're diversifying our energy needs. And this is a good thing, no matter if you're in the oil business or the solar industry. It's a good thing because we need more than one leg for our stool. As the Arab embargo of the 1970s showed, we can't be dependent on someone else for our energy. Well, we also can't be dependent on one substance for our energy that is also created by lots of other companies and countries all throughout the world that may or may not have our best interest in mind. And by the may or may not, I mostly mean may not. So that all being said, it makes sense that we're back in the $70 to $75 barrel range. It's reasonable. We have a big demand to expand, but we have kind of a cap on how fast we can do it. And when OPEC is saying, all right, we're going to release some extra oil out there, you can just, it goes without saying that the frackers are doing that already. They're pumping quickly to take advantage of these higher prices because they're still burned from last year when a lot of them went out of business from negative oil prices. And that was a long kind of mixed up statement that our economy is expanding very fast at a point that I don't think it could expand faster than it is already expanding. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. The other thing that's going to affect the price of oil, and it's way out in the future, but it's going to affect it, is the fact that Mercedes and Volkswagen have both announced that by the end of the decade, by the end of the 2020s, they will no longer be making gasoline engines.
Yeah. Ford, General Motors, all of the major auto manufacturers have a different prediction. I talked about General Motors saying this last week. Ford said it this week. They expect in 10 years that more than 50% of the cars being manufactured will be electric. And we've got a lot of other stuff to talk. I actually want to spend some time on that subject, but we have two questions that are hanging out there that are both fantastically good ones.
Good.
The first one is from John, our most loyal questioner and listener, presuming that he actually listens. He might just email us questions and then not wait for the answer. I actually think he knows the answer to most of the questions that he sends, so he should be an attorney. Okay. So, John's first question, subject line, student debt. I understand that private lenders stopped making student loans several years ago, leaving Uncle Sam as the sole provider. Biden is hinting that he will cancel all or part of outstanding student debt with an executive order. Can he do that? Okay, so there's some misconceptions in here, and he may know this, and that may be why he's doing it. There are still private loans out there that are still being issued for student loans. They're both being issued in the primary market and the secondary market. What's that? A primary would be you're a student, you're at the campus, and you say, I need a loan. Private loans are still there. They have some different regulations than they used to. And still, by far, the largest lender is the United States government. In the secondary market, that's when you're refinancing your student loans. There are federal and private refinancers for that as well. The regulations on student loans still apply. The things like whether or not you can stop making your payment only apply to federal student loans. Okay, so let's move on to the next one, because regardless of whether or not private lending is available, it is such a small percentage of the marketplace and has been a small percentage of the marketplace that it's not a major player. Biden's hinting that he will cancel all or part of outstanding student debt with an executive order. No, he can't do it. I mean, he could write the executive order, but he couldn't do it. And why not? Well, because this falls directly under Congress's purview. The executive branch has some leeway to forgive certain types of loans for certain circumstances, but only the leeway that Congress has given them. In order to actually forgive the debt that's held by the U.S. government against many, many U.S. citizens that have gone to college, Congress would have to act. There are exceptions. Congress has already acted in certain areas, like people that work for not-for-profits or governmental agencies that fall within certain categories for a 10-year period without missing any payments, have forgiveness. So a lot of times you'll hear about this with teachers, but it's true with firefighters and people that work for not-for-profits. The difficulty is actually getting it forgiven because there's a backlog of these applications. And a lot of times people send in the application, and by the time the application is approved, they've already paid off their student loan on their own. So just keep that as a side note. How we forgive student loans is another thing. So, for example, you can do an executive order as the president to forgive student loans to a university that was in some form of malpractice. And Congress already gave that purview to the president. So if there's a for-profit university that has a bunch of public student loans on it, and it's proven in court or shown with a strong amount of evidence in court that it was sort of a scam, that you really couldn't get a job with any of the designations, credentials, or degrees from that university, then the federal government quite often will forgive those loans. That doesn't mean it's a total loss to the government. The government then tends to turn around and go after the university or educational institute to see if it can recover some of that.
And there's a point to that, by the way. The fact that the United States government makes student loans indicates that they, in essence, are approving of the education system offered by that university. They're only supposed to make loans to accredited universities and schools, and sometimes they don't. They just make loans because you apply for the loan.
Right. There is a fantastic article on this in the Wall Street Journal this week. John, I know you get the Wall Street Journal, and the headline is "Al Lord Profited When College Tuition Rose. He's Paying for It Now."
Yeah.
And it's the former CEO of Sallie Mae, who's now paying for his grandkids going to college. And the average cost at public universities for a four-year tuition is $200,000. And yes, you heard that right. That's just a normal public school education. This isn't a private education. It can easily...
It's per year.
No, not per year. That's the total. Okay. Per year, it's anywhere from $28,000 to $50,000 across the United States. For a year of tuition, and you multiply that times four, and you can see where it gets up to $200,000 very quickly. If you're going to a private institution, that very quickly goes up, and the top end of that is in the millions of dollars for 4 years.
20 years ago, when doing financial planning, we estimated that it would cost $20,000 a year to go to the University of Texas.
Right,
and that's not even vaguely correct today.
Yeah, it's up by 50%. From that, and that's just phenomenally large. And when you think, you know, there's a lot of people that recall going to a public institution when it was still really seriously considered a public institution, and you paid $100 for your semester. Well, that's not the case, and hasn't been the case for a long time. Our educational system has gone from a well understood, not competitive against each other set of institutions designed to keep prices low, to everyone can afford it while they're going because of student loans. They may not be able to afford it in the future. So let me give you some behavior. Why am I coming at it this way? When you're setting a price at a restaurant, at a store, you're selling something. So you're selling a sandwich at a restaurant and you raise the price. If someone has to pay for it right there and the price goes up too much, they say, I'm not going to buy $20 half sandwich. That's unreasonable. This is not being made by a French chef in the back. This is somebody sitting in front of me with plastic gloves on their hands. I'm not going to pay $20 for a sandwich. However, if they don't really understand what the price is today, if they're on some kind of a plan where somebody else is paying for that and they have to pay the someone else back, and they go to the counter and they get the same sandwich that they got last year and that their friends got last year. And they just buy it. They go. Raising the price doesn't stop people from buying it. Now, when they come back and they say, I didn't know the price got up this high. How am I supposed to afford this? This is more than my rent payment paying for these sandwiches. I know I'm stretching the analogy, but bear with me. The sandwiches are what I'm sticking with.
You could be talking about the medical system, too.
Exactly. And that's where I was going to combine this. The government has gotten involved by providing basically loans to anyone for anything when it comes to education. It's vitally important that we educate our populace. I mean, it's a fantastic investment in our people to educate them. But without checks and balances, what it's done is it allows the colleges to raise their rates however well they want. There's no downward pressure from the marketplace because the marketplace isn't really what's making the decision. They can pay for it. It's just 5 years from now when they have to start making their payments and they realize how expensive it actually was based on income or not income that they have at the time that they're making the payment. So this is the same in healthcare, in that no one, if you have trauma and it's life-threatening or just really threatening, and you go to a trauma center, it's a not-for-profit trauma center, which gives them tax incentives to, they don't have to pay taxes the way a for-profit institute would. They can't turn you away. They've got to treat you. It doesn't matter if you can pay. And that causes prices to go up. Well, the other things that cause prices to go up in both college and on the medical side is that after years of this habit of we can raise prices because that whole group of uninsured people aren't paying for their health insurance, or we've got enough money coming in from the funding and we could put in a new program over here in the psych department. And if we raise, it's overall, it's a better educational atmosphere if we increase this department size. Over the years, that becomes a habit. There's no force to say no. There's no negative to that positive input. So it doesn't need a reason to go up anymore. And you can see this in lots and lots of systems and economics, but these two are very, very clear. There's no reason not to raise prices because it's going to get paid somehow, which means that we've got some kind of a weird Frankenstein of capitalism and socialism kind of trying to stagger along together, and the end result is it's going to fall down. We have to redesign both of these systems for it to work. Forgiving the debt is far worse than a Band-Aid. It is like we're just going to erase this and make it not have happened. What happens? Does that mean forever that school is free for everyone? And by the way, as a side note, I'm not necessarily against that. It works well as a public institution for school up through K-12. It keeps people literate. It gives them skills. But we haven't really made a decision, yay or nay.
If higher education was based on academic skills or technical skills, we treat it the way it's treated in Europe, for example.
Right, which was designed by the United States.
Yes, where if your skills lean towards, let's say, being a mechanic, then you go to technical school and the government pays for your technical school so that you can go, and well, the government and the industry together pay for your technical school so that you can go out and learn how to do, you can learn how to do something that you can actually apply and have a job when you finish. But the idea that, I don't remember how far back when we started doing the guaranteed student loans. The issue is not just that loaning money, it's guaranteed student loans promised a profit to Sallie Mae.
Right.
No matter what they did. There is no credit check. There is no check to see if what you're buying is worth what you're paying for it. You know, if a private lender, if I want to go buy a car, and I go to USAA and say, I want to buy a car and I want to borrow the money from you, USAA looks up the value of that car and tells me how much they'll loan me based on what they, if they have to foreclose on that car, they have to repossess that car, how much they could get for it.
No, here's the problem. It's really hard to repossess a brain. We're here to take your education back. Please start coughing it up.
But the point is that if you look at an education and say, how much is this worth in the economy right now? And you say, that's a reasonable price to pay for it, we'll loan you that much money because your income will be higher because you have that, likely to be higher because you have that education. On the other hand, a lot of people are getting educations that they can't get jobs with. Well, you can get a job with it, but you just can't get a job where you can pay off your student loan.
Right.
There's no cost-benefit analysis done on educations by the lender. The government doing it by itself is probably far more effective than Sallie Mae, where Sallie Mae was guaranteed a profit no matter who they loaned money to, so they would literally loan money to just about anybody.
Yeah, I mean, this is a behavioral study. You could do this on rats. If you get a benefit to do this one thing, no matter what you do it or where you do it, guess what? Rats will do that thing. Well, so will people. So will corporations.
So would Sallie Mae.
Yeah.
So a lot of money was loaned to people to get educations that they couldn't make a living with, and we have to do commercials.
Yes, we have to play some commercials. This is a subject that could easily take all of our time for the next 4 months, and we still wouldn't cover the largest part, I mean, maybe even the smallest part of it. So it's a vitally important area to continue conversation about, to figure out what is the balance we should have between capitalism and socialism in education and in medicine. It's a debate we've been having for decades, but if we look at it based on rational understanding of economic consequences and benefits, it seems to make a better decision-making process. But I could say that about almost anything, including having babies, going to the grocery store. Anyway, we've got to play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. We have a question hanging out there from Philip, and if you would like to ask us a question during the break, email addresses in here are jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com. That's Tango, Papa, Whiskey, Charlie, or The Personal Wealth Coach, and we'll be back on the other side of these announcements. And we are back. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and we've got lots more to talk about. Lots of tough stuff, good stuff to talk about this Saturday, July 24th, 2021. Philip says, top of the morning to you. Thank you, Philip. That's very nice. He says, could or would you guys address what I think is an oncoming economic crisis due to our federal overspending and the effects of the pandemic in lockdowns and paying people to stay at home? So that's the first part of it. I see countries around the world that are less prosperous or developed beginning to really feel the impact of the past year and a half. I'm concerned about higher inflation and quite possibly my employment in the future. Philip, thank you very much for this question.
That's a lot of question.
Yeah, but it's all interrelated to itself, even though it doesn't seem like it. So the first thing is the concern, overspending at the federal level, effects of the pandemic and lockdowns and paying people to stay home. So overspending on the federal level and paying people to stay at home kind of fit into one group there. Then lockdowns. So it's like governmental effects because of the pandemic on the economy. That's your concern. The government shut down the economy to some extent, large extent, by mandate saying, hey, we got to stop the spread, then went and spent a lot of money on stimulating the economy that it had shut down. What are the future implications of that? That's how I'm interpreting that question. Then the next question is about, well, it's more about a concern, countries that are less prosperous and developed beginning to really feel the impact, and then concern about higher inflation and his employment in the future. I'm going to tie it all together because it's a really all the same thing. First off, we're concerned about the effect of the pandemic and all its implications on the global economy down to the individual scale, my own employment. When we see less prosperous nations that are really feeling the impact, the reason why they're feeling it is because they didn't have federal spending on their accounts. This is preposterous in a non-emergency situation. You would never hear us say, let's have a bunch of government handouts when the economy is doing well. This is something that both major, even political schools of economics, the originators of these schools can agree on this. This is Milton Friedman and Keynes, John Maynard Keynes. The left has taken after Keynes, the right's after Friedman. Because Friedman's like, the government should stay out of the economy. It should just get out of the economy and stay out of the economy. And Keynes is, hey, in really important situations, the government needs to get involved. That's kind of the, in a nutshell, theory behind them. The problem with that is those theories aren't quite right. Because Friedman says the government shouldn't be involved except in emergencies. That's the right-wing side economist, who was not really that right-wing. He was an economist. Keynes said that the government should pay back its debt during good economic positions. So the left says, Keynes says we're allowed to borrow as much as we want. Friedman said, don't borrow, just have a big cash pot that you use in the event of a disaster. Texas does that in the rainy day fund. So, but he also said that in the worst case scenario, when you're in a disaster and you don't have a rainy day fund, you need to borrow money. Because that's absolutely common sense. If your house burns down and you don't have a bunch of savings and you can go get a mortgage, you should probably get another house. Hopefully not live in a tent. So if you have the ability to get the loan in an emergency, you should take it.
One of the problems with having the savings is it slows the economy down.
Right.
In other words, money that you put into savings to replace your house in case your house burns down is money you didn't spend in the economy that didn't create jobs, that didn't create people making things. And economies that have done that have become pretty stagnant, very stagnant,
right.
As a matter of fact.
Just look at the savings rate in Japan. They've got a very slow growth rate, and because of that high savings rate, a high debt rate.
The government in Japan has offset the high savings rate of individuals by having a current debt owned by the public ratio of about 270% of its gross domestic product. We're at about 100%.
Yeah. So the government of Japan holds a lot more debt, partially to provide the savings that the people of Japan have, because it's the same number. You consider the debt of Japan in the bank account of a Japanese citizen as reserves to the citizen, but debt to the country. So it slows things down. So when we see countries that are less prosperous, that are going through the same issue that everybody else is, that haven't had the stimulus, they're just trying to deal with the economic impact of the other developed nations' demand fluctuations based on lockdowns. But they don't have like an insurance system, which is what our government has been acting as, to back them up.
One of the ways that you can look at this, and I just got the data and I was looking at it and thought it was interesting. Let's presume that the recession of 1920 was caused by the pandemic, the so-called 1918 flu,
yeah,
which is generally accepted to be probably true.
It's a pretty accurate statement, yeah.
That recession, and recession, by the way, is measured from top to bottom. When the economy starts falling to where it hits bottom, that's the end of the official recession. I don't like to use that. I use recession from the top to where it recovers. But the official length of a recession is the period of time during which it falls. And the National Bureau of Economic Research just came out this week and said, the recession we experienced last year was only 2 months long. It's pretty severe, but we got over it. We're getting over it. As a matter of fact, we've recovered from it by every definition, including our definition, by now. So in about a year, we recovered. In 1920, when the government didn't get involved and didn't throw a lot of money into the situation and didn't borrow a lot of money, the recession lasted 18 months. In other words, the economy, the market, and everything about it fell for a year and a half, and it took about a decade to recover. Now think about all the jobs that were lost and all the taxes that weren't collected because of it and all the pain and suffering and foreclosures and everything else that went on in the 1920s as a result, the early 1920s. And you realize that all that money that was borrowed and pumped into the economy and given to people who weren't working apparently has sent a jolt through the economy that has caused us to recover ever so much quicker. It's an experiment.
Yeah.
We tried it. We've tried it in the past. We tried it in 1929. We tried it in 1920. To see what we could do to get ahead of the system and not support the economy. And it didn't work particularly well. Now, we've done the complete opposite this time around, and we really won't know till the end, for a decade or so how it worked out.
Right. So,
but I think it's working pretty well so far.
From the federal standpoint, when we look at it and we say, all right, what is the purpose of a government? Well, the number one purpose of the government is to protect its own people, protect it from natural disasters, protect it from outside invasion, and to protect their interests abroad. That makes sense. I think we can all agree on that. This is a natural disaster. This is why we have FEMA. So the government spending here is, in essence, insurance money. Insurance money is inflationary at the small level and at the big level. If you just inherited a bunch of money through insurance that you're not used to, you're going to spend it quicker than you usually would. That's just backed up by study after study. Same's kind of true at the mass level. I mean, if you look at the inflation rates around New Orleans after Katrina, not just because of shortages, but also because a lot more insurance money was hitting the area. Beer prices doubled in a very short period of time there. And it isn't because it's harder to make beer. It's just there was more money available. You can see this in places like San Francisco where the income goes up. Well, this one time or few times insurance payment that we've gotten from stimulus plans and from unemployment payments going out from the federal level, that all amounts to the same thing. And we actually have to cover this more next hour because we haven't really touched it enough and we're about out of time for this hour. This has been the Personal Wealth Coach. And if you'd like to talk to us off the air, we have voicemail waiting during the week, real live people during the weekend. Locally, the number is
254-947-1111.
You can reach that toll-free for those of you that still have landlines at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. We've got podcasts, links. We've got radio programs going back lots of years. Our newsletter's there. You can sign up, and you can contact us through the contact form or email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. We've got lots to talk about next hour, more on the subject of what's going on, inflation, employment stuff, what we expect in the future.